begin?
It is 2:10 and 25 seconds.
Okay.
On the autumn equinox.
Is that today?
Oh, it is, isn't it?
September. My grandson's birthday.
All right.
So I can remember it every time.
I think your notebook might be in the way of the slide.
Tough.
Maybe. Very black hole.
Anybody have any announcements or?
Yes. Well, I just have an announcement that I got hold of Joe Gator. Yeah, Joe Gator. And I got the stuff you sent me. Mm-hmm. It was exactly what I was looking for.
Okay.
The only problem is, I think that's what I really want to. I'll explain the, like, put together a whole process, the whole things I think would work really well for the marine environments. The only problem is that it doesn't go for all of Whatcom County.
Right.
And just, really unfortunate, because that's the part I really wanted to see. But I think that the technique and the methodology is really good. Mm-hmm. It's really detailed.
They did a good job from when I read through this paper.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really interesting. But anyway, we can get into that.
Okay.
Yeah.
But glad you got it.
He said they would review it when we come up with something. They'd be really interested to see that.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be good just to press the communication with them if they ever expand or redo
He's
that
frank.
Study.
Yeah.
Be nice to include Whatcom County in that.
Yeah. Well, the LIDAR is interesting, and you can maybe we can get into that whole discussion when we get to that.
Okay. So
it's
the only...
Hello.
Hey, Frank.
Hey, how you doing?
Thank you,
please. The only other announcement I had was, thanks for the critical areas layer with all those habitat conservation areas. There's the wildlife folio from 94, mm-hmm. 2005 WDFW data, and 2015 WDFW data are all on the critical areas maps now. So all of the natural resource planners basically have access to all of those shape files now whenever they have a permit coming in. So we've been able to overcome that first hurdle of at least all the data is in the ARC reader system now, so benefit.
Progress.
Yeah, it's a good little improvement.
Although it won't show up in any users if somebody clicks into the critical area maps that are posted on the website for anybody else to look at. That hasn't changed.
Not yet.
Yeah.
So I guess probably that'll happen once the critical areas update is finalized, then we'll take those updated maps. And yeah, for the most part, I've been the one working with our GIS person to update those maps, so those will be the most up-to-date CA maps when they're released.
Will we have access to those before it goes to public review, just so we can...
Oh, yeah, I have it all now, so
if
we want to spend a meeting going through it, yeah. I play around with it almost every day, just looking at different layers, so... Yeah.
I want to introduce Al Scott Johnny here. He's currently our manager of our Cultural Resources Department.
Great. Welcome.
Hi.
I'm a guest here. My name's Shauna. I'm a botanist for the Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest.
Oh, okay.
And I'm Vicki Jackson. I'm a wetland wildlife biologist in the area, and I'm the chair of the committee.
Okay. I'm Barry Winger. We met long ago.
Yeah.
It's good to see you again. And I'm retired from Department of Ecology about 5 years ago now. It seems like a long time.
Okay.
I'm the vice chair.
Yeah, I saw your name, so I just made the assumption that you were still with the Department of Ecology.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm free.
Say what I want.
So am I.
Yeah.
I'm Chris Kasner. I'm here as a non-technical representative.
I'm Chris Elder. I work for Whatcom County Planning and Development Services, so I get the staff of the committee. But yeah, I work for wildlife issues and also do farmland preservation work.
Oh, okay.
And then the members that aren't here are Fenner Yarborough from Washington Fish and Wildlife, mostly terrestrial stuff, and then Joel
Ingram
is mostly fish stuff, right?
Fish and habitat, yeah.
Plus we've been,
Guy.
John.
John McLaughlin, he's a wildlife professor at Western. And that is from the technical committee.
That's us, yeah.
That's us, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I emailed that information to John Campbell, that guy who came to our last wildlife committee. Haven't heard anything back from him, so.
Okay.
So I don't know, it probably would be good to do another outreach blast, to see if anyone else actually wants to join.
Yeah, it'd be nice to fill that one spot you.
Lost one of your numbers.
Sign up.
I'm not right now.
You just didn't have enough time.
Only because I'm somewhat concerned, like if this gets extended, like how much time to be putting into the committee past, your guys' like due date right now.
Right. Fair enough.
Great.
I guess for today, maybe we'll just kind of go through the draft, habitat descriptions to start chewing through what kind of we came up with. I guess while you're here today at some point, probably be good just to talk about how we can capture kind of the cultural component in these habitat descriptions or maybe in the existing ecosystem report in general.
Yeah, and to put it in context a little bit, what we're working on is developing a existing conditions of wildlife habitat within Whatcom County. That's a document that hopefully the committee will put together and the conditions of the habitat, the issues that are there, and suggestions for rectifying or studying or something at the end. So we've been working on this in fits and starts over the last several months. We've been interrupted by the critical areas ordinance, kind of reviewing it and the comp plan language, and we're just sitting back down to this existing conditions report. And our task right now is just describing different kinds of habitats for wildlife that occur in Whatcom County.
So those two other documents that you referred to, what sort of impact, I guess, or what sort of impasse, I don't know which is correct, I guess, as far as you know, becoming a point where you folks had to stop for a little while?
Well, yeah. Maybe Chris can summarize the history briefly, right?
Yeah, in a nutshell, I think some citizens brought forward concerns that maybe we weren't effectively planning for wildlife and kind of habitat, so council essentially requested that we develop this kind of existing condition report, you know, what is the state of wildlife and habitat in the county, and are there any things that we should be doing differently to better protect those? So the report in and of itself is just going to be just that kind of a report, you know, what's the state of wildlife and habitat in the county? And ideally, you know, kind of the conclusion of that will be where we identify, you know, where are some data gaps or what are some recommendations, how can we better plan for wildlife and habitat? So I think that's where I guess the council could have the opportunity to kind of pick up on some of those recommendations and turn that into a new policy or a new program, or that part is still unknown. So at this point, we're kind of doing this baseline report, but in that baseline report, we'll kind of identify what's lacking or what should we be doing that we're not doing currently.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out which kind of the crosshairs, because there's, you know, I mean, there's a sense with the Growth Management Act that goes down to, you know, to different aspects when it comes to cultural properties, at least in that arena. But maybe I should look at this ordinance number 215031 to get a better gist of that, I guess. And I can't distinguish at this point because I hear him say non-technical, and I guess I hear there's technical, assume that there's technical as well, so I'm just trying to get a gist of that. And reason being is because also there's another group that's the Timber, Fish, and Wildlife group that has other scenarios, but not just as focused as with regards to wildlife habitat. I mean, there's other arenas of that, so I'm just trying to see where a better engagement can occur at, I guess, than when, where, and why kind of approach. So
it's a complicated landscape, you know, because you've got federal, state, local, and even special districts, you know, tribal stuff. And if, you know, all these things intersect in all these different plans and actions, and how do you make it all kind of, how do we get kind of a comprehensive picture of all that? That's what we're trying to do, is just start, what's our baseline here, what we got, what was historically here? And then there's all the conflicts that come up, you know, between state laws that allow killing animals that come on your property and may threaten your garden, right? Well, you know, there's not, we can recommend those get changed, of course they're not at the local level. But, you know, there's other things that we can do as far as gathering information, where we see gaps, and where are the corridors where animals migrate, at least seasonally, if not on a permanent basis, what kind of protection are they having right now? And so most of the time, when planners get this information, they're not getting it at the permanent level. It's sort of like in fluffy language, kind of in the comp plan and maybe in the shoreline program. But then when they try to go, when you get a proposal in, it's like, where's the gauge? Where do they weigh it against? You know, you get buffers and stuff, but there's a lot of stuff that's just missing a lot. So that's what we're trying to pull together, basically. That includes, of course, lots of cultural things, including not only the tribes, but cultural things between, okay, ranchers and elk, or, you know, like in Montana, or ranchers and bison, because the bison have a natural migratory thing in Montana and Wyoming. And now there, I guess there's like 5,000 really native bison left or something. But they're going to have this big conflict with the ranchers, because they think they're going to get brucellosis, you know, from the bison, though it's never happened. So there's a cultural class, well, like wolves and people, establishing wolves and grizzly bears is all the same thing, a cultural clash. So how do we work all this out?
Yeah.
And get it so that we're looking at it on a regular basis. You know, we're pretty good at looking at fish on a regular basis now, but wildlife is always going to take in the back seat. It's not easy.
It seems to the technical non-committee, so the technical committee members are responsible for actually developing this report, kind of the existing ecosystem report. But the additional full committee members, once the report is done, we go back to, since they're a full committee, and then review it with everyone just to make sure that it all matches up before we take it as a full committee to county council.
Okay.
And even though I think we are trying to write a report for the entire county, you know, essentially county council in the lower western lowlands / foothills are kind of the area that we're going to be most impactful. You know, we're not expecting to change national forest policy or even DNR policy.
Yeah, it's kind of the focus, because that's what the county's got for regulation. But at the same time, we're cognizant that just like fish, you know, they don't stop at the boundary. They go up to Canada and they go up into the mountains. And so you got to recognize those connections and the significance of those, and the land use activities, like the forestry stuff we were talking about, and roads up in the Forest Service, even though we don't have control over it, the county could say, hey, this is what we've noticed, and that's affecting this area down here. We need to come up with a better way to, you know, work on this together. And, you know, the tribal input's actually a good way to bridge that gap. So,
you know, give me your email address, and I can forward you that ordinance that...
Sure. So on the cultural element, what are some of the hiccups, I guess, or considerations? I mean, sometimes they're the same.
I mean, like beavers, for instance, it's against state law to trap a beaver and move it somewhere. So even though it might be a problem with beavers here, and you might want to have beavers over here, you can't do it under state law.
Yeah,
but you know, and from culturally, but you know, from a environmental standpoint, those beavers make great, you know, ponds and backwater areas for coho. That's the whole Skagit Valley with beaver everywhere. That's why they had such a huge coho population, and probably same thing up here in the Nooksack and more channels and it's, you know, more natural. Now, you know, you got people that just take beavers out no matter what.
Yeah, because cultural is pretty much taking a back seat to everything else.
Yeah, cultural and wildlife, I'd say.
And now it's just not starting to come to the forefront. So some of the stuff I sent you the other day,
sure,
is a big sign that it's it's reaching the federal level now. Pretty soon it's going to start trickling down to the county levels and local jurisdictions, because it's become a big topic now.
Yeah. Well, more people, more fences, more roads,
right.
More interactions or conflicts, and then you get special interest groups that run, they want their ATVs out there in wintertime when the elk shouldn't be disturbed.
Yeah.
So this is replete with conflict and cultural issues. I mean, cultural in the big word, big sense of the word, you know. So.
I don't think we've quite hit those hiccups yet, but I think probably appreciate all of your input just as we go through, whether it's habitat description or the larger kind of plan, how we actually capture and consider cultural.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to do this real quick so I make sure I...
We've done it.
Yes, yeah, so actually the other one's kind of come up is recreation. We have so many people who are into outdoor recreation with bikes, mountain bikes, and hiking, that kind of stuff, and kayaks, canoes, and everything else. And so, you know, at a certain point we get that much traffic going through an area, and especially if it's like a nesting area in the summertime, in the winter or springtime, you know, you really need to kind of close those trails down just so that the birds can have a place to, you know, smoke, you know, breed and stuff. But that could be something that's, you know, temporary, a couple of months or something like that. So then, okay, then you can open it back up, and that's kind of a nice way to manage it.
Yeah.
And same thing with fisheries. So you got windows you got to close, you know, for because, you know, they're spawning or whatever's going on. So yeah. That's one of the tools I think we're looking at.
Yeah. Well, I think that the application, even like with critical areas of nesting of eagles and so forth, and you already have that template there, so mm-hmm. it's a matter application across the board versus where it applies here but it don't apply there, where it really should be considered I guess as far as consistency.
Right.
Okay. You guys want to jump into habitats?
Might as well.
So I guess based on our last meeting, these were kind of the
That was my glasses.
That's your eyesight now. Your glasses aren't helping you anymore.
So these were the items that we had listed for what we wanted to capture in each habitat description. So there's quite a bit there. We've had variability in the detail descriptions so far. Maybe we can just pick on thinner first since he's not here.
Which I'd forgotten we actually had those elements, and I made the comment down here about his. Maybe we should move that to another part. No.
What was your comment?
When I was reading through it, I was thinking we were just doing the descriptors, which Ryan didn't mind. It was just descriptors, but he's talking about the effects that the activities in his habitat would have on wildlife, which I think were excellent. It's just I'm not sure if they want to be in this section or we want to have a separate subsection that addresses the vulnerability of these different habitats rather than building it into the actual description. It seems a little awkward in that spot.
Okay.
Just a formatting element.
Yeah, so what would the other section be?
Threats or impacts, public craft that, something to that effect to these habitats.
Yeah.
So vulnerabilities to the
subcategory.
Yeah, maybe make a link, like just a sentence that links it to that section. So going through this stuff, we say, okay, I want to know the threats about gravel pit or gravel mining.
Right. Yes.
Goes in this section.
Down here. Right. Yes.
Yeah. Concise way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, maybe we can pick on Shauna first, since she actually did the most comprehensive description.
And it's still very rough. Because I need references.
So
like you got something in.
digging for gold someplace, you know, it doesn't occur.
So this is 27 low and temperate coniferous forests, so western hemlock zone. Is that an accurate descriptor, like western hemlock zone? Is it still pretty?
It depends on
which one you're using.
Yeah, what classification system you're following. Historically, historical vegetation classification systems have gone by zones, and Western Hemlock Zone would be correct. Now it seems like the current classification is going towards matrix lands, something called matrix depending upon the stand size, and Western Hemlock Zone is not recognized in NatureServe's classification as occurring in Western Washington.
Should we put a footnote to that effect then?
Or should we can, but it was something I was going to actually propose to the group, that we not follow this vegetation classification
this
system.
This is more the Doppenmeyer kind of...
Yeah, that we follow NatureServe, since that's the most current scientifically supported classification for Western Washington.
Which one is?
NatureServe.
Isn't Hemlock considered like a alder of the upland slope in the forested areas, isn't it? I mean, if a timber company goes in and clear cuts an area and doesn't plant anything, isn't it more likely that you're going to get hemlock back than anything else?
Yeah, you'll get hemlock or you'll get Douglas fir. But this classification system with the zones failed to recognize the importance of Douglas fir in Western Washington, and so some of the new classification system kind of breaks Douglas fir out. It breaks out like the lowland forested types from more montane forested types, because the climate is different, so the species assemblages are slightly different and for different reasons. It's more detailed. See, I'm a splitter, I'm not a lumper, so.
So what would you... You just call it the lowland temperate coniferous forest, or?
Can I think about it some more and maybe propose something at a later date? And it also depends how this is going to be linked to wildlife habitat, because if, for the people that know wildlife, it's my understanding that some wildlife are specialized and some use like a broad range of habitat types. So if we're going to be speaking from a wildlife habitat type standpoint, then maybe using the broader classification system would be better. And then I remember last meeting people talking about how the habitat descriptions could potentially be used by field personnel. And so if we went with like the NatureServe classification, you know, Washington State already kind of has a draft key to ecological vegetation types, so they could potentially use that key in the field to determine what type of habitat it is, that they then could use to determine what type of wildlife may occupy that habitat and what they should be considering.
Is that key?
Okay. I gotta look it up. I'll let you know. Give me 5 minutes.
Do you know if this is being used for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which would be nice to have Joel here when they're doing their new analysis?
Joel probably had a kit. That's probably where he's at.
You're right.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. He was expecting a kit. That would be it. But they're doing their like watershed analyses, and whether they're breaking things down to that degree. If they're using particular categorizations, it would be interesting to look at, because it would be good to be consistent with their analysis.
So is that what you're describing, is that under the ecological process then, or is that, I'm grasping here, kind of grope here, I'm trying to see where, you know, the puzzle pieces are thick.
Well, at this point, just today, what we're just talking about is the different habitat types, and we're just trying to capture, like, what are the distinct habitat types we have in the county, and then just provide roughly a description. So we're going to try to include identification, description, a rough ecosystem role and function, what species use that, any critical considerations, current status, threats, seasonal, cultural. So ideally, every different habitat category, as we've broken it out, can have all of this information. So hopefully this will kind of be our this will be our own internal key that we can then use to reference in the other parts of the report, help kind of describe the concepts better.
Because I'm just getting a little confused when the description, I guess, regardless of the description, the hemlock is important because it is directly associated to what habitat, what plant, what animal, what other species, so I've just been a little muddled and trying to see that clearly as well. And it's because for us it would be a plant indicator, plants and fungus and those sort of things. And then that's directly associated with treaty rights for us, along with cultural property, cultural significances as well. So I'm just trying to.
Which might be a way, an interesting place to segue in some cultural aspects, is looking at these species or habitat descriptions that we're generating and having you look at those and tie in treaty right elements to those different habitat elements. So if it's the fungus, collect, you know, whatever it is that you would be tying to your treaty rights.
Yeah.
So.
Which may be a good argument for keeping things, instead of lumping, keeping things kind of separate, because then more specific. Yeah.
And even though we're
reference in there, because they're organized. So.
Oh, all right.
So even though we are the Wildlife Advisory Committee, this is still intended to be like an ecosystem report. So I think the more we kind of maybe not make it wildlife centric as much as kind of ecosystem centric, I think is a better approach, just to capture all considerations. So this one here, huh?
Yeah. I'm not sure why it's still in draft 8 years later, but I can call and ask.
Lost funding to finalize it?
Yeah, I don't know if it's been accurate.
What number was the hemlock forest?
27 lowland temperate coniferous forest.
And with regards to.
There's another printout right there. Too,
yeah, where did they come out of that? I can't remember. I thought we were using the ones out of the 94 wildlife modified list in the back of Anna Eisinger's.
Yeah, that's what I started with.
Okay.
But as I worked with that, I just had some recommendations.
I'm looking at the Eisinger report. I don't see it even in there. 27 Subalpine Forest Park.
So might have remembered, or maybe did you add that one in that wasn't in there before?
No, it was definitely.
Oh, it was.
I don't know what number it was. Sorry,
Logical pine forest at 28.
With regards to the being a splitter or a lumper, it seems as though if you're a splitter and we can start with keeping things split and divided up, we can always lump it later.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to split it once you've lumped it. And as we're looking at how the other descriptions for different areas come together, then I would say I would just keep going.
Splitting. I'll split. My next attempt will be splitting.
I agree, because actually on the marine system, there's lots of small subcategories, but if you in a GIS system, you can say, okay, give me all the sand and gravel bottom types or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's many different forms of that. There's wave forms, and there's flat forms and cobble forms. And then that you can then sort a lot easier if you split them out. Whereas if you've lumped them, you can't really do that anymore. And it makes a big difference in which species choose which ones.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be 29 high elevation temperate coniferous forest.
I was doing 26 lowland temperate coniferous forest, western hemlock zone.
Is that different? It's different than mountain hemlock.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not a tree person, so bear with me.
I have a question, sort of just to clarify a little bit. So when you're talking about this an ecosystem, lowland temperate coniferous forest, western hemlock zone as an ecosystem, do you take into consideration, is it referencing only like a non-disturbed stand of trees, or are you talking about, you know, just because there's so much extensive logging out here, does that kind of clear the slate and become something completely different after they've cleared that, or is that still considered, you know, Western Hemlock Zone?
So I was considering Western Hemlock Zone. This is a good question. So I was considering Western Hemlock Zone to be anything currently existing and managed for forested stands.
Okay.
So I did note down somewhere when I started writing this section for threats to habitat. When I started writing,
I think right above that threat
status to habitat and trends.
Yeah.
This used to be likely the most extensive vegetation type in the county. That's
that
has been lost.
Okay.
To these other habitat types that we're also going to be defining, like agriculture.
Right. So then it would kind of the definition would kind of focus would shift to agriculture if they clear cut everything and only planted Doug fir. Is that then?
No, that would still be. No, that would still be managing for forestry resources. I think if they planted nothing but Douglas fir.
Yeah.
But if they clear cut everything and then seeded it with a grass seed, and now it's, you know, they're growing reed canary grass for some strange reason, then we've converted it to farmland or pasture.
Wasteland.
This is where, if I can pull it up real quick, in our descriptions, so we tried to actually have these qualifier codes afterwards. So after it's been clear cut, you know, maybe you have an open sapling pole or mature old growth or clear cut, so it still kind of qualifies as a lowland temperate coniferous forest, but it's just been clear cut. Ideally, you know, part of this is actually developing a toolbox for natural resource planners or consultants to be able to go out there and since you write that evaluator, it's like, yeah, it's a lowland timber coniferous forest, but its current condition is clear cut.
Right. Or it was clear cut 15 years ago, and now you've got a bunch of slight alder or something.
Yeah, all over the place. Okay, that's how I was.
Well, thanks. I was just
so is there a historic profile then in this regard? Then? I mean, because regardless of the activity, whether an agricultural activity that has impacted and more effective, then there's logging, and then there's other land use development as well. Is there a historic profile reference that would, if I hear forest planners and so forth, saying, well, this is good. This would be likely and appropriate to begin to consider these. I mean, it's like alternative A, maybe we want to put more hemlock in that particular area because of, or, you know, because they're basically there's a lack of it. Because I think that there's, you know, and I kind of lean towards the ecological, when we need to be able to invest back into that at some means in our measure.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in time, and then you know, so because and somehow, if I hear someone saying planning aspect, that I'm thinking that they're going to have these kind of considerations to look at, and these sort of options that would fit within them that particular area, and, whether it's because historically, my ancestors burned certain areas. And then these, then this would occur in that particular area. So
you're kind of saying, potentially to each habitat description, we would add kind of a historical condition potentially, and then also recommendations for.
It's something to consider. I'm asking that is there a historic profile? Because and I think that becomes something that I would look at and say, if I'm going to do, if I was a forester, I'm going to propose some sort of forest management plan and a proposal that I would need to have to take a look at what was there. And then take it from there and say, okay, hemlock may not be the best thing for the first 10 years or 20 years, but it may be something that we want to look at it in 20 years or so as far as the health of the ecosystem, whatever it may be. So it's a question.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like what you were just saying, might be a good opportunity, us reviewing this might be a good opportunity to kind of put that kind of a historical, cultural subcategory in there under each habitat.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be hard for the ones that I do, because I couldn't, I mean, cemetery or gravel pit.
Historically gravel pit.
Or even characterize it at all. I mean, cemeteries are in different elevations, different, I mean, it's
Other than you might be able to document, or we could come up with when gravel mining became a more prominent mm-hmm. activity in the county,
right.
and that may have had effects after that or mm-hmm. due to that. So it's something, just a historical marker of some sort. So mm-hmm. I like that concept, and you know, maybe more appropriate and more developed for some habitat types than
yeah.
others. Mm-hmm. Some in themselves are like a cemetery or already a modified action, but.
And elaborate on how you're involved with either of those.
I think I was just the default person that you'll do it.
Yeah,
I'll do what Chris tells
me. He wasn't here one day. So
right.
You nominated him to do it.
He's the strangest person, so
yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it would be.
I know Brent worked too. So.
So we'll just put maybe one additional bullet in each habitat description, if we're able to get some historical data, just include that.
Okay.
That sounds reasonable.
No, I like that.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess one thing to keep in mind is that these habitat descriptions, at least in terms of the, yeah, so Western Hemlock Zone, I mean across the entire county, it's not site specific. And so that was something that I struggled with when I went to write this habitat description. You know, one, I work in a very specific part of the county that I'm very familiar with, but then I had to, like, you know, look at Google Maps for the rest of the county and be like, so, where's forested areas in the rest of the county, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the land management there? So I think it's really hard for some of these to get into a lot of site-specific detail, because we could dig and spend lots of time and write pages and pages of site-specific detail. But I think that might be something that we want to back away from under habitat, getting into site-specific detail. I think site-specific detail might be better suited for when you're describing like the animals and the habitat that they prefer and where and their ranges and where they might occur.
I mean, I agree. I mean, if we're not careful, this is going to end up being a 200-page report,
mm-hmm.
which no one's ever going to read. So, ideally, I think keeping those habitat descriptions as succinct as possible, and basically, if we're providing the toolkit such that down the road, a wildlife biologist, someone could actually incorporate this data for a site-specific project. I think that's what we're aiming for. So yeah.
Well, there's nothing that's going to prevent you from can succinctly describe it here, but then there's a great detailed, explanation of it, some scientific paper, just saying, okay, that citation will give you all the details.
Right.
That's the way a lot of them are. But like, it's true, if you put the detailed stuff in there, no one's going to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we might.
Okay.
Yeah, it's got to be readable.
Let's roll through here, and I guess if anyone has any thoughts mm-hmm. or if you want to explain anything as we go.
No, I did change the headings of what we were supposed to be describing. I think we were originally asked.
You did what?
Okay, so what were we originally asked to describe was identification, description, ecosystem role and function, species composition. I just kind of changed some of the headings. I thought I still captured the information.
Write them down so I can compare.
Mm-hmm.
And did you just do the part in 27? You didn't add the lodgepole pine forest?
No.
Or the, because that looks like the original already.
I didn't.
Yeah, okay.
Did you do that species crosswalk?
Yeah, that's something that I think we need.
Is that a, is that supposed to be a complete list, or is it?
Not right now.
Okay.
It was just me throwing in some species.
Okay.
As an example.
I was gonna just suggest a couple more species to throw in there.
Which, this could be a very extensive list, whether we just want to include the dominant or indicator species that you'd find.
And my species crosswalk was really just referring to the species that I listed under species composition in case they wanted to know what the scientific name was.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see.
Because I was using the common name.
Yeah. I think the hope at some point is that we can actually develop kind of a smart Excel spreadsheet that actually has these habitats listed, and you can actually reference plant species types, wildlife species types. So I kind of have that preliminary list started, and I guess another update that I forgot to mention, I did finally send off our internship request to Huxley, so I've already gotten some interest just today, so I think it's likely that I will have an intern to help support, especially that kind of species and habitat list.
Can I ask a process question? Is after that document that you just sent to me on that ordinance, under function part, it seems to have the list of target groups of sort, whether it be under the GMA, open space, enhanced recreational opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. All of those. Now, are these species, as you speak of that table or that matrix, do these species then begin to address where they're appropriate, not appropriate with those, that kind of template or outline?
You mean, are we going to be making recommendations on where they should be or shouldn't be? Or?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
I mean, so I don't know. I guess the short answer is we're not quite there yet. Longer answer, I mean, ideally, I mean, it probably depends on the species by species. You know, Department of Fish and Wildlife is already managing or developed a management plan for a particular species. I don't think the committee is aiming to kind of try to start operating as our own independent Department of Fish and Wildlife or anything. But if we've identified, you know, gaps in habitat connectivity, or we've identified a habitat, but we know that there's no species there, you know, we can recommend.
But the idea at some point is to be able to provide them something that would guide their planning process and or their management planning.
Right.
And so I'm trying to see where that links, if at all. So I mean, because at some point in time, because it isn't clear to me, I have to kind of ask that particular question as to where does that connect and or don't connect. Because I'm hearing the process of a matrix, and then those that might be listed out as by species or whatever it might be, but I'm trying to still make it connect to either forest management planning or wildlife management and planning.
I mean, I guess for this document, you know, we're identifying habitat types that exist in the county, so just based on our knowledge of those habitat types, you know, we can also surmise what species, both plant and animal, should be connected to that habitat type. So a lot of this is like guiding development. So if I come in and I want to build my house and I have this identified habitat on there, we know that there's going to be black bear and bobcat and bald eagle, so therefore that property owner would then be required to have a development plan that still plans for those wildlife species as well. So it's hopefully we're fleshing out a process for planning and development services where when someone comes in for a permit or a project, they have a little bit more guidance on how to plan more effectively for those species and that habitat. So I think, you know, on paper, connecting those species to the habitats I guess I don't quite know how it hits the map or hits the ground necessarily. You know, we're not going to necessarily be throwing all new wildlife overlays on the map, but maybe we are.
Okay, no, because I see the land use permit process being, you know, have some indicators in there at some point in time, and I can see some planning documents that would, where you have a process to provide guidelines for them,
mm-hmm.
And I'm just still trying to, I guess, solidify to see that.
Yeah.
It's like my dominant eye is my left eye, and for some reason or another, my right eye keeps on going like, you know.
That's kind of the word we have on the street is that no one really knows how to plan for wildlife at this point in time. You know, you've got like the bald eagle guidelines and maybe a few other management guidelines, but by and large, no one knows how to plan for a functioning ecosystem. So we're trying to help.
And certainly nobody knows how to very coordinate between all the entities that are involved.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's actually true to do the same thing. We're all wall-eyed and then we're, you know, cross-eyed because we're looking at something's going to be useful at a project, practical level,
yeah.
But then also somebody's going to guide like park plans and transportation plans and energy plans and all that sort of stuff. So you are working at different levels simultaneously.
Yeah, and I think we as a group have already discussed that this existing condition report is kind of just that in its own, it kind of stands on its own. The next step would be how you integrate that information into the planning process. And hopefully that baseline information, which we lack at this time, can then be sifted into kind of, okay, or, you know, is downtown Bellingham an appropriate place for black bear? Somebody else will make that decision based on the existing conditions information that we've generated. Or the questions and gaps of information that more information needs to be looked up about that. But I think that's kind of a next step, but it's a really perfect, clear-eyed question. what are we going to do after this? We're going to get this piece of the puzzle first.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully just nailing down these habitat descriptions will kind of help create a language that we can all kind of reference and be on the same page with as we go forward to actually evaluate, you know, what is the actual status of this condition, so, or the distinct habitats. So my hope is that with this intern, a little bit more GIS time, we can actually start looking on the map and determining, you know, how much lodgepole pine or lowland coniferous forest do we have left in the county. And should we be planning for encouraging more of that, or do we need to protect what's remaining? So yeah, we're still a ways to go.
Remember when you cut off population growth?
Luck with that, yeah.
We're gonna build a wall and make Skagit for it.
Yes, for number
two. Build a wall.
Start
yeah.
At home.
I know Trump's number.
I'm done too. So.
Okay.
Is that why Joel's not here?
Yeah.
Did he have his kid?
Yeah.
All right.
It's 2 days ago.
Oh, okay. Congratulations.
I think he's off for a while.
Yeah. I'm a girl.
But he emailed me today. Stop working.
Well,
I didn't write the email. Yeah. I can look it up.
Do you get a name? Do you get a name?
It's on the email.
Oh, it'd be like Tony. It's good. You could move
it. I just saw healthy 8 pounds.
Yeah,
that's and he's off, so don't bother.
Yeah, that's important. He may think, God, I need to do something else for a while. These diapers and stuff are getting to me. Probably not.
Right.
Let's get work. Okay.
Well, the description that you started with looks well-structured, and I like the idea of following the more accepted methodologies and just kind of mm-hmm. continue on with that, which may mean that we're changing.
I got to start over now.
Yeah, to get rid of lodgepole pine or whatever and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And build into what would be more currently accepted across
so
the board.
So, where's Nature Serve? Is that, what's that from? I'm not familiar with that myself. I mean, I've heard the name, but I don't know.
Oh, who
Come out of DNR, or is it?
No, it's a standalone nonprofit.
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
It does kind of conservation planning.
Mm-hmm.
Huh, okay.
Do you guys use that Forest Service? So what, how do you guys use, maybe I need to talk with you afterwards.
Well, Nature Reserve is right now kind of like the mega corporate warehouse for all listing information for species. So that's what we use it for.
Yeah, so you do a lot of your own GIS mapping and kind of reference.
I do. Like every employee for the Forest Service is required to do their own GIS mapping. Don't have GIS people.
I might come bug you then. I've tried to get into the whole Nature Serve thing and it's,
oh, really?
It's pretty complicated.
Okay.
At least without having someone hold my hand as far.
Where's your GIS here?
I do a lot on my own. We have another GIS specialist that kind of guides me.
Who's that?
Sarah Watts. She's been here for 20 years. Yeah, I think, you know, history of Whatcom County has actually laid off one of their GIS planners back at the 2008 crash, and they never rehired it, so we're essentially still down a GIS planner, which is kind of what some of us have tried to pick up the slack. Yeah.
Unfortunate in this day and age.
Yeah, and then Whatcom County definitely has some room for improvement with regards to our public GIS interface, which doesn't exist. Okay. So I will reference that. So I guess when you look through this field guide, Shauna, we probably have several other headings that could use a rewording?
Yeah.
Reclassification?
Yeah, definitely. For the forest, it stands. That's as far as I looked.
Okay.
How old is Nature Serve? Is that a program that's been around for 10 years? Or?
At least
10 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They used to have a different name. But I can't remember what that was. Or Nature Serve broke off. It'll come to me. It's been a while.
Yeah. Is it an open source program or is it proprietary?
Open source, I guess. If I'm understanding it, it's a non-profit. The information online is available to everyone.
Yeah, but the program itself is something you can actually change or modify if you need to for your own. Purposes, that'd be open source. Proprietary would be if you like something from Apple, you got to get their permission or get them to reprogram it or tailor it to your own, but they still own it.
It's a lot of like tools that you can actually use with ArcMap.
Yeah,
so
they have tools. The data is available.
To help you evaluate data sets. So, yeah, I guess there is.
Yeah.
Can they buy them from them?
No.
Okay,
it's
so
free.
It's open source.
Yeah.
And is it Washington State specific, or is it?
They have every state.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Who has everything?
Nature Serve. Nature Serve did used to be part of the Nature Conservancy, right?
I don't think so.
Okay.
So if we went back to our GIS person, they should be able to.
Yeah.
If I can get a contact of who that is, I'd be kind of curious.
I can email you too. The website.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've downloaded it. I just have not figured out how to use it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, let me look at my phone too.
I
could just type on my phone.
We'll get to the point I can give you an update where I'm on the marine systems.
Well, why don't you go ahead and do that? I think we at least have a good introduction to Sean is reformatting, and even seems like I'm going to need to go back into the ecological systems and update some of our categories. And I'll.
What Sean is doing is not changing anything of what we're working on as far as the items you want to see in each habitat category.
No, other than we did a...
I think the base content is still the same.
Other than adding an element of history that we added in.
We had history, probably history.
Yeah.
That's actually natural history.
Cultural history.
Yeah, I think it was cultural and natural.
I just have historic profile on there, so what was the state of the ecosystem before?
Yeah, okay, cultural considerations and historic profile, okay. That makes sense. That's what I was kind of wondering, so if I... Write this down somewhere on these.
And I can email this out after I meet today also.
Not speaking.
Yeah.
It is, they used to be part of the nature conservancy.
So what do you do?
On the marine stuff, I'm pretty familiar with a lot of the work that's been done over the years by DNR, WFW, NOAA, Sea Dock Society, and especially the Salish Sea area, but also there's, there's the shoreline, it's called shoreline inventory and analysis done for Whatcom County. There's a shoreline restoration plan that has a marine section in it. Talks about all the marine shoreline areas that could be, that are impacted, which ones could be actually restored. And actually there's a number of things that could be updated probably on that. But when it comes down to actually the detailed stuff, that Gary Green from UC Davis and Jay Gatos from the Sea Dock Society actually put together is really amazing mapping using SciScan sonar and with a backscatter application on it, which basically, and then uses LiDAR also to overlay all that stuff. So LiDAR will give you a really detailed image of the bottom, like in Bellingham Bay. You can see the fumaroles where methane gas has come up over the years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
There'll be little vents basically out in the bay. But it also shows all the little trenches, little pinnacles, and everything else, and those are all. But without that, you don't know what they're made of, right? So using SciScan sonar, you actually get a really accurate topographic profile of it.
Uh-huh.
And then the backscatter bounces the beam in, and basically how it scatters, they measure that and they can tell if it's sand or rock or wood or silt. And so it gives you a really high resolution.
Wow.
And so they've done it. Is that, Chris, actually it's pretty interesting. Do you have that? Do you send me?
That paper? Yeah.
Just not the paper,
the map.
The map. Because, so Gary Green in 1999 started working on with a whole bunch of other scientists, trying to come up with a standardized classification. This is for basically deep water sites. So everything in Alaska, off the coast of Washington, D.C., Oregon, actually even around the world, so that people could compare. And a lot of it's driven by the geophysical, the geology of what they find on the bottom. So it's a very detailed thing. But some of these areas are huge. I mean, they're hundreds of kilometers area. They call those the mega zones. And they have a mesozone, which is maybe down to like 10 kilometers in size. And then you get down to macros, which are like 1 kilometer to 10 kilometers. Then you have even more detailed stuff down to specific boulders and cracks. and it makes a big difference, because in the marine environment, I mean, all of your critters, or at least most of them, can fly, basically. So whales go all the way up to the surface. They sleep on the surface.
So you can actually kind of track the flow of sediment out into like an estuary or a bay or...
Oh yeah, absolutely. Not only can you do that. So this is interesting right here. Let's see if I can get this out. So this, can you scan out? So these are all, there's a long key up here. So it shows you, the problem is the coverage that they had to do this with NOAA, they did it with NOAA, Sea Dog Society, and the group came out of it. But they only came in this far. So here's Lummi Island. So all this, there's LiDAR for this park, you know, that's what this is. You probably can't see it on here. There's like a little pock mark there and another one.
Yeah.
Those are the methane fumaroles.
Really?
So, but you know, you see the deep scarp right here. And unfortunately, just off the map is the Cherry Point. Little kind of ravine that comes in where all the Cherry Point herring come in when they come ashore. It's a critical feature. Then offshore, they thought out over there, but one is where it's a big, called a holding area, where the herring, Cherry Point herring, school up for weeks at a time, basically, and ripen more and more.
Yeah.
And they're not all that sensitive at that point in time, so ships can actually kind of go by them and it doesn't freak them out. But then they all, when they want to spawn, they'll head down to the bottom and follow that contour along the bottom. So it's a defined corridor.
Hmm.
And they come into the shallow water, and if they get hit with light from a fishing boat, it freaks them out. They go, they get out of it, screws them all up.
Huh.
So that's why this whole study about herring, behavioral studies of herring Cherry Point has been so critical about the GPT thing. But when they get to shore, they don't care. Now they're in spawning mode, and they go up and down the beach and find wherever their, you know, macroalgae they want to use, and you can't even go out and get them, and they'll keep spawning because they're. So it's kind of interesting. They're in the holding area, then they're in the corridor where they're really sensitive, then they're going crazy. So, but their habitat was all over from Point Roberts down to the northern part of Lummi Island, 36 miles, and now it's just shrunk down to just a short area right around kind of Point Whitehorn and Birch Point, a little bit by the refineries.
And part of Fales Passage, and at the west shore of the Portage Island there.
Yeah. So, get them there. So, what this shows you though is that this is the kind of sediment types. These are sand waves. So this is sandy bottom right here. And they're like sand dunes, except they're real small, like 3 feet or something. Go through here because of the currents and stuff. So this is all sand here. And some of these are gravel. So the interesting thing is, just like all the terrestrial animals, you get kind of an assemblage of different in land. You get, you know, certain assemblages like in prairie areas. Certain animals you're not going to find other animals there usually. Or in old-growth forests, you find a certain group of things that, you know, spotted owls and, you know, flying squirrels or whatever. It's the same thing here. So in those sand dune areas found in, you know, Sea Dog found over on San Juan Channel, they have the same kind of sand dune because of the currents right here. And Pacific sandlands are found there in enormous numbers, like 16 million they found in this one dive.
Huh.
Yeah, and they're down at 300 feet. And those Pacific sandlands are the ones that are forage fish that spawn way up on the beach, right up by the drift logs. And when you walk around like a Cherry Point, you can see them, then they'll dive into the sand and then like, they disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So they had no idea why these fish would be down there. They still don't, actually. Someone's doing some research on it. But there was 16 million of them. So they went down with a remote operating vehicle, you know, underwater device to check their findings. That's what they did with all the stuff. They said, sit down, and then they sent divers down to certain places.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so by figuring out what kind of bottom you have, and kind of currents and everything else, so you can kind of get an idea of where you're going to find rockfish, where you're going to find juveniles, where you're going to find crab. Like in Bellingham Bay, a couple of areas that are really critical are over here and over by Governor's Point for shrimp and crab in particular. Huge, hugely important areas for the juveniles in particular. So if you take this information and you take all the other information that's been done on kind of near shore areas and then actually the riparian areas along here, you can get a pretty good kind of a collage of habitat types. You can see there's going to be a lot of different habitat types. But, and that's why I was talking about, you know, there's so many different, these are just the benthic, you know, strata. This is kelp and eelgrass and macroalgae and all the other stuff. So you add that stuff on top and, you know, it gets to be a really big list. So that's why you want to be able to, but it's critical that you can tell if it's this kind of a waveform or that kind of a waveform. If this is gravel here and this is sand here. But because in the larger gravel, you're not going to find sand. That's if they don't use that. So anyway, I think it's a real fabulously productive and but time could be time consuming effort. I think by putting all these different data sets together and connecting them, you can put together categories that actually would work pretty well.
So do we know, I mean, since most of this, their actual work was done outside of the county,
right?
How do we apply that to our county?
Oh my God, I keep asking. Well, here's the county line right here.
Yeah, so it's just a little snippet.
Yeah, I know.
Teasing.
So it's just...
But the you have LiDAR. The LiDAR is pretty interesting.
Yeah, the LiDAR you got. But the other thing is that you also have charts and stuff that will have. So this is a high detail, high resolution information.
Right.
It's been tested actually. Then you have all the old chart information. So you got the depths. So depth is real key also, because in all these systems, they're looking at basically, near shore areas, tidal. Subtitle is shallow down to like 10 meters, kind of mesolayers down to like 30 meters, 100 feet. If you can find the contour lines on it, the chart, so you can chart those out, then beyond 100 meters basically.
Actually, some of those charts have the material
at
the bottom too.
Mm-hmm. Yep, is it mud,
rock? Yeah, sand or rock.
Right. So that, I would say that's, you know, those are kind of by observation.
Yeah.
And so I'd say that's kind of a low resolution layer. But you can fill in a lot of that stuff in here. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this is going to be a rock face because it's a rock that's going over, you know, the mountain. So you can come over here. So I think for these other areas, you can kind of piece them together and just say, okay, that hasn't been tested for sure, but this gives us an idea of kind of the scarcity or the, you know, commonness of that kind of habitat. And then you've got all these different features. And sort of like the same thing in the significant wildlife. That Heisinger said, you know, you have talus, or you've got caves, or you've got ledges, or you've got, I mean, pinnacles, and all those things are, or you have coral formations. Mm-hmm. And so, all those turn out to be really critical, you know, especially if that could be a little boulder field. And then some of the research I was looking at, there's these boulder fields, and they're just super stocked with juvenile rockfish, even though they're at 300 feet. Mm-hmm. Which makes you wonder, what are they doing down there?
They could keep away from us.
Or keep away from predators, probably. But then, so then you start thinking of all the mammals, you know, the porpoises, you haul out areas. There's islands that are, you know, they've got a beady rocks. And all those places are extremely important because they've got kind of a vertical as well as a kind of a spatial area around them. And now that some of that's described in a lot of these different documents. Anyway, I think it's possible to pull all that together. Then you've got estuarine systems. Maybe there's a whole bunch of categories. Some Cy Simonstad from the University of Washington, who's a great researcher in this sort of stuff, basically, has put together a categorization process and came up with about, there were seven different groups. And the interesting thing he did is he looked at certain kinds of sites and they used Puget Sound as the test area and they could figure out if it's in this, if it's less than 10 meters from zero tide, which is called shallow subtidal, it's going to produce these kinds of features, or these kind of features are associated with that, eelgrass meadows and bull kelp and macroalgae. And you're going to get a lot of the schooling fish, like herring, sand lance, surf smelt, rock sole, which are then the primary predators are those, are those fish are salmon and there's a whole bunch of other things. If you go to a little deeper, like the mid subtidal from 10 to less than 30 meters, you tend to get crab and shrimp concentrations, but you also get demersal fish, which are ground fish. So there are things with different classes on here. So you get assemblages of true cods, hake, ling cod, flatfish, and rockfish, adult flatfish, adult rockfish. And then the main predators on those things are, of course, sea lions and seals and orcas. So anyway, you get these assemblages from the typical critters that live in that habitat unit, I guess you want. And then the animals that actually use that. So there's these kind of food web subsets.
So if we, on the classification that we have up on the screen right now, would you recommend that we consider adopting that breakdown in classification based on their research, and then make it a future action to recommend that be applied to the rest of Whatcom County?
Yeah.
Try to flesh that out?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because that makes by far the most sense. And then, but then it, I think it can be enhanced by looking at some of these other systems and see how they interact with them, like the sign and stat thing. And then for the shore forum, on the shore populations, Megan Dithier from the University of Washington, Freddie Harbor Labs, kind of wrote the book about it in 1990. And that's been kind of the leading characterization. So she looked at, you know, exposed rocky shoreline, in this zone it's going to be, you're going to have fucus, and you're going to have, you know, whatever, other protected areas, you're going to have all the, the laminarias and that sort of stuff.
And what is the source of this here?
This is actually from UC Davis, University of California, Davis. But they have a program called CDOC, and it's that their base is on Orcas Island. And so they've been working with NOAA, and it says it's at the bottom of the chart, I think. It's NOAA and, oh yeah, Geologic Survey of Canada. Because the boats that could actually do the sites that sand sonar and the backscatter had to come from Canada.
Yeah.
So that's where they linked up them, and then NOAA helped do a bunch of stuff.
Well, in general, that profile would, transition over in regards to the cultural properties and their significance as well, because you then have this this classification ability to look at areas, and then we have our checklist that we have as well, is that when we look at land use activities or whatever they may be, other activities, and then we can kind of say, okay, we need to take a look at this a little closer.
Mm-hmm. Right. So. Yeah, because, you know, so the kind of impacts, so what I've done is actually taken these several different systems and trying to see how they kind of fit together, and they actually do fit together in a really interesting way. So I could be real useful. It's going to be at a higher detail than the
stream splitters.
These guys are planning on, you know, huge areas and stuff. And I think they did this in a way just to kind of do a real detailed one to see how it would work.
It'd be kind of interesting to see what their planning documents, I guess, and their management documents.
They are really truly a scientific and education group. They're not a governmental planning entity at all. They're trying to get information out of what's down there. Because they did the study all the way up into not as far as Desolation Sound, but up to at least the 90. And so off the Fraser River, they found a 60-foot-high colony of cold water coral live. Something like, they're called icicle coral, they found in Norway. No one knew there was any in this whole area completely. And it's this big cone of this coral. It's probably 10,000 years old since the glacier or something.
Wow.
And then, so it's like, what's this doing? Yeah. And it's stuff like, they found all kinds of stuff like that. It's pretty interesting.
Are any, like San Juan County, are they using any of that information in their planning?
That's a good question. I don't know. I would doubt it, actually. I'll find out. I know. I think all this looks...
Well, it's a treasure trove of information. So
it is.
It's a matter of...
But, you know...
Gather it up and...
Yeah, but what's it all mean, kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
But the thing about it is, if you don't know what you have, you don't know where you lose it. So if you're going to put a pipe along the bottom, what's it going to run through?
Like a gas line?
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Because I know, in my old office, in fact, I know where the boxes are even. There's video on the, at the bottom, going from Cherry Point all the way to the Nine Mile.
Hmm.
It shows exactly what's on the bottom, and is detailed anecdotally for the GIS.
Hmm.
Still there.
Because they're...
But it's never put into a system.
Well, you know, the pipe's going to come in use pretty quick because, you know, they're proposing a gas...
Oh, I know. Exactly right. That's why I went in to find it. Yeah. I want to make sure I knew exactly where they're... It hadn't gone down to archive in Olympia. Where you'll never find it. So they're going to keep it there for me, they said. So. But anyway, yeah, but, you know, the other thing is there's impacts, you know. In these high-resolution photos, if you look at Susha Island, you can see where the anchor buoys are,
uh-huh.
And the chains dragged around on the bottom. It shows as
yeah,
a scar.
The line right around.
Yeah. Yeah, and shipwrecks show up. Underwater ancient villages or features show up. Pretty interesting stuff. They've found quite a lot of that kind of stuff up in D.C. and Alaska, too.
You find that, can you let me know?
Yeah. I'm going to run into that because that's probably kept in a separate file somewhere. But it's pretty interesting. You know, you look at LIDAR, it's not an interesting feature. Why does it look like that?
Yeah.
It's unusual.
Well, it's incredible the way they can use the LIDAR.
I mean,
they can pixelate right down to the make of a type of species of bush.
Yeah.
Or a blade of sedge or...
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
What are they?
I don't know what those are. Yeah, you have all kinds of creatures and stuff. You can see, just really amazing detail. Those pock marks.
Yeah, just a ton of pock marks in there.
Hmm. Yeah, that's sort of the Liza Island. You get the nice deep ledge that falls off there.
Crabbing edge.
Where to put your crab?
Yes, right.
And actually, that's the other thing, because you can figure out what areas you don't want to have trawlers going through, or you know, anything dragging on the bottom. Places where we don't have anchors going in, because maybe it's like there's the only cold water coral formation in the West Coast or something is right there. Mm-hmm. No one knew it was there. Someone could drop an anchor and destroy the whole thing in no time. Mm-hmm. So. It seems like there's lots of features coming back here. Anyway, it's going to take a while to see all this done, so but just letting you know that's where I'm going with it.
Good, I'm glad I have a cemetery around with it.
Isn't there some kind of weird classification system of cemeteries? Mm. There's the green cemeteries now, and
pet cemeteries.
Aren't they stacking people now?
Yeah, or the fungal mat thing they wrap bodies in and they just dissolve. Wow. Yeah.
You want cemetery? Sounds like you got a lot.
That's okay.
You can watch it too
that's
much
okay.
TV. I don't know.
I haven't even started my wetland thing right, so.
You want to go over your gravel pit?
Yeah. Well, I think, go ahead.
Just following up on the cultural stuff, though. So when we kind of get some of this stuff together, we kind of look at, okay. Here's the area where, you know, I know but by Cherry Point, there are lots of crab pots that get lost. That, you know, they're always getting rid of derelict nets and that sort of thing. We can kind of keep track of some of this stuff better. Or say, here's an area that's, you know, we really shouldn't have anyone going in this area for whatever reason. So it'll be an interesting dialogue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ignore my comment because I forgot that we're supposed to be breaking this down this way. Ignore me completely.
I think you are kind of on. I couldn't find a whole lot of kind of citable descriptions of gravel pits. It was very informative. It was either really basic or really only basic. You know, We have some stuff just from, we have a lot of swan mortality in gravel pits. So we have some just anecdotal stuff that we put together, but man, it was hard to find anything that was really comprehensive. Talking about gravel pit habitats. If anybody knows anything, I'm sure Barry knows.
Well, Paula Cooper's a good source for getting this stuff on where gravel pits, because they have the records of volumes that we've been taking out of the river and other sources. But the habitat part, that's a big question.
Yeah, I mean, you can go to four different gravel pits and their habitat is completely different around it.
Yeah, I know.
So are you trying to characterize what it grew in the gravel pit or the surrounding area or...
Or are we just trying to acknowledge that they exist?
They exist
and they cause problems.
And they, yeah, like I was on one this week that had the greatest number of noxious weeds I've ever seen in one place.
Wow.
It was just amazing. But no water, it was all dry land stuff.
Oh, no good?
Yeah.
Where was it?
It was a rock sand road.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, definitely.
There's a restoration site just out here, actually, not very far. That's it's a 12-acre site.
It's
right down here.
Yeah, somewhere.
Up Deer Creek?
It's just on this side of Deer Creek. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was done for the Walmart. It was putting, I think, it was off-site.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, right.
And it actually came out pretty okay, I think.
I have never seen it. I was involved with that one early on, and then with Jim Riggins.
With Jim Riggins, yeah.
And he created some ponds that were shaped like fish.
Yeah, if you look from down
here,
yeah.
If you look from the sky, it looks like a northwest kind of caricature.
Motif of a salmon.
The purpose he did it.
Yes.
Yeah, he did like it on purpose.
There was no reason not to separate art with restoration.
Yeah, he's kind of. But it's kind of interesting because it is protected in there. You can go in there, and there's just tons of birds.
Great swan.
Yeah,
swan love it.
Yeah.
What's the deal with the swan mortality?
But there's
lead and stuff.
Yeah, a lot of them eat lead and they get over there on those gravel pits where they like to roost at night, you know, they like to get the gravel.
Yeah.
And they just
Jetson Lake.
Never make it off there.
Huh.
Yeah,
especially right there in Emerson. I mean,
yeah. People shooting. Jetson Lake.
Just over the years, it's built up of bullets and stuff in the gravel pit.
Yeah.
There's a couple lakes up there, Jetson.
Wiser.
Wiser isn't as bad as Judson's the one that we just can't fix.
That straddles the border too.
Yeah,
parts of
all that lead just accumulates in that vegetation. We tried chopping it up. We tried putting bamboo poles everywhere so the swamps won't land. And it just doesn't work. We had 200 and some dead out of it.
Really?
Did this have the Emerson for you?
So
just Judson Lake there.
Yeah, so then there was a proposal to dredge it to make it deeper so they can
get one of those marsh masters in there.
Yeah.
And try to chop it all up.
Yeah. But they have to dredge it, I think, for this summer.
Nobody has money there.
I know.
Yeah,
But it's not a gravel pit.
And other people think,
right?
No, that's not
no.
But other people think that you count 16,000 swans last year was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of hard to argue.
It made a good comeback.
The numbers are still way up from what they used to
be. Yeah, but when you see them, they've got their lead poisoning. They're just kind
of. Oh, yeah. I found three of them last year that I reported over on Linden. I was done hunting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then just like next row, just grouped over just laying in the mud.
Yeah.
Still alive.
Yeah, see, like a Ferndale.
I have a question in regards to your sand and gravel description. And, again, with the historic profile, because I'm familiar with some of the areas the North Fork there, just above what they call the USA Bridge on Highway 9, where it has shifted, historically has shifted. You're specifically referring to gravel in the existing pathway of the river, I guess.
Well, center that would put that one together.
That was another thing that I wanted to talk to the group about. I mean, how specific do we want to get on this as far as acreage in Whatcom County? Or do we need to do that? Or do we want to keep it really vague and basic and just characterize gravel pool?
All right.
Which that's hard. it seems like that's a common theme for a lot of these things. Cemetery, I mean, golf course.
I would just do more of a...
Parking lots, it's like, there's so much variation.
I would do the same thing we're kind of doing with the other sections. That is, just make it as simple as possible, because it'd be kinds of impacts. And then reference a different section, if you got, if there's more detail, it could be added later even. Because there are records on like how much gravel is taken out of the river and all these different gravel pits.
So we want that kind of information.
Well...
I don't think we want it in the actual stuff we're writing, but we could cite it. And, you know, or, you know, as people find stuff, they can connect it to it. So, I figure we'll do the same, but it's gonna be added to it.
Okay, again, here's where I was going, is that, on the, there was a historic village, on the North Fork there, between what they called, Jimmy Creek and just, heading east of that. And, you come through where the pipeline comes through, between there and Rexack Road. Okay, like when you come there, there's probably about a space that is about as wide as this office space and just about as deep that you go down, then you go back up, which was the old riverbed. So now, and the old village was on, basically on the south side of that, so I, you know, so I guess that's the cultural content and context I'm trying to identify in this process. I mean, that's, you know. Whether, and that would be on kind of on a historic, but then at the same time, if they're looking at some sort of a planning document, and let's say all of a sudden that the property owner sells his property so that they could have, you know, motorcycles that go through there, sort of a thing, is there impact and effect there? I don't know. I'm, you know, getting trying to gauge where some of this. Because I think that there are some areas that historically that had been in the last 125 years where there were some more historic sand and gravel, and that there were some, I guess, right in the current pathway.
Yeah, I think your description is aiming for areas that have been actually harvested for sand and gravel.
Okay.
So more barrow pit kind of activities within the channel or separate pits in there. So not necessarily where the river is moving or changing, but where they're actually collecting it.
Yeah, because actually where the gravel is kind of naturally, it's, that's fairly easy to get from superficial geology. It is a big area. It looks like it's a big basket of gravel, basically.
I think Whatcom County is actually hiring a consultant next year to do an update to our MRL, mineral resource plans, of what is the estimated capacity, to kind of identify what remains out there.
Yeah, there's a lot. Unfortunately, a lot of it's under farmland because the river flooded, set the silt and stuff out, and made really good soil over hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. But underneath there's the paper zone, which is all the groundwater's gone through. But it's tons of, I mean, it's 3,000 feet wide. And,
yeah, I live on an old historic riverbed, and it's you go down a certain depth, and then you bring in all this foreign soil, so everything you plant will only live until the root system is able to, you know, exhaust itself. And that.
Right. Well, and actually, I was going to bring up something else too, because one of the impacts from having, like, you know, gravel pits is they get abandoned, people dump things in them, whether cars or anything you get into the groundwater. So it's actually a really vulnerable place to pollute groundwater. isn't there still a little garbage dump out there, right in that area you're talking about?
There's a Cedarville one. There's the
is that on the channel or Highway 9?
No.
Well, Rustath Road has a dump site for fill.
Okay.
I don't know if that's what I mean. Yeah. So soil and aggregate remnants.
Okay.
from when? Was it Rexxed or the, I'm thinking of the auto one that was down the road then.
Oh, on Highway 9?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Okay.
Well, they shut that down. I think they were forced to clean it up, man.
Yeah.
The one that was right on the bank of the river?
Right.
Yeah, they shut that down and they made them move everything out.
Oh, good. Because, you know, that's another thing, you know, there's contaminant, these gravelers can contaminate really easily. And then once it gets into the groundwater, like, it's really hard to get rid of it. Or it goes in the river. That's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot of the mining operations too, are a big concern. Today there's a big concern. Yesteryear, there was no concern about the tailings.
Right.
Now, you know, there's a concern about it, but now you got thousands of cubic yards of tailings 500 feet from the South Fork, near the headwaters of the South Fork, that nobody's even considering about going and cleaning up.
Right.
You know,
they're
but,
gone.
Yeah.
The people did it. They're gone.
Yeah, so.
And that's true, like, I was going to say, in the marine environment also.
Yeah.
You know, dioxin in Bellingham Bay.
Oh, yeah.
You've got wood waste, you know, 2 million cubic yards of wood waste that was dumped in there for the mills, which are probably still on the bottom wandering around somewhere.
Well,
on Wolf's Beach.
I was told years ago that some of the loggers used to take some of their wood and dump them in lakes and bays and stuff and sink them to make ironwood out of.
Oh, really?
Which they make the keels out of the boats.
Oh, really?
With.
Huh.
And I've heard that south end of Lake Whatcom is loaded with sunken, I mean, rail cars and rail cars full of the old growth that was sunk for just that purpose. And as far as I know, it's never been.
I was just going to say, someone should do, if they haven't done it already, do a LIDAR of the bottom of Lake Whatcom.
Yeah.
I bet that'd be pretty fascinating.
It would be. I mean, Lake Whatcom has been,
kind of like
it's got a lot of history to it. I mean,
yeah.
And you think about it, you hear some of the stories, you know. Wow. And they used to float their logs all the way from the south end to the lake all the way to the north end and float them down Lake Whatcom Creek.
Yep.
Right down to the mill, the Railroad Avenue, I mean, Holly Street there.
F Street, I think.
Yeah.
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 Oh, there's other stuff around the county and the marine environment, too. The old boat yards.
It's incredible.
Yeah. But
anyway.
Is that...
I've got some ideas to add some stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
like
the swans are an important, I mean, that's a cool bit of information.
And that's Watkins specific, isn't it?
That's a good point about the dumping, too. That's, it becomes like a magnet for that kind of activity, and then that, yeah.
It'll bring it around.
Shooting.
I was going to say,
shooting.
Actually, you know, like the 2008 inventory, the shoreline inventory, picked out, there was two big gravel pits up by Everson. Told me the names, I can tell you if that's right or not, but they were actually over 20 surface acres. So even though they were man-made dug holes, they became shorelines of the state. They're under shoreline management.
Really?
Yeah. And they've been given, they were given shoreline tests.
Oh my gosh.
So we called the owners in and said, here's the deal. You're too big, you can't fill them in now, so you're going to have
then, to. Put the cleanup on the state?
No, it goes with the people, but the thing about it is that they have to get shoreline permits to do any kind of development, like a subdivision.
Yeah, like the end of the whole road and not the whole road area?
It's yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, it's fairly large size there.
Yeah, Van Boten maybe?
Yeah.
And there's one on one side and one on the other side. I can't remember if they both got in or not, but anyway, the consultant's actually in the inventory report of the natural. What they can figure out from what's there naturally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's there now as far as the natural,
right,
like bird attrition and stuff.
Huh.
I don't see any rail cars in there.
Maybe it's not.
I mean, I'm sure there's probably slightly different kinds of LIDAR that helps get through the water surface layer.
It was like
a LIDAR with a side.
Well,
yeah.
You know, we were. I was talking to a couple people about that a few years ago, you know, and we were considering going out there and doing an exploratory search of the area. But then we started thinking, you know, this is, you imagine how many feet of silt will be down in there? I mean, it's buried.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, so you're not going to, it's going to just look
over. Well, yeah, there are people that actually do that for a living. They dive in big lakes like, you know, Michigan and everything else and blow these old logs. Some for a fortune.
They are worth a fortune.
Yeah, because they did that in Lake Washington. Yeah. And they got permits to go. It's always
super dangerous to do it just at the depth of Lake Washington.
Yeah.
This is another tangent. All these yellow dots here are the mortality data I got from Department of Transportation.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we start kind of going through our kind of corridors and
they look really uniform.
Deer? For animals or for people?
Yeah.
Or both.
What are we talking about?
That's wildlife.
Otherwise,
so yeah, that doesn't help too much, except that everywhere there's a road.
You know where most of them are getting killed, where most of the people are driving.
Yeah.
That's a tangent. So I guess those were, you three were the three that actually shared or did your homework.
I only sort of did my homework. I only added just a little descriptor, and I didn't get any facts further than a couple of descriptions. So I don't count any of my homeworks.
What is your section?
Wetlands.
Okay.
Yeah. But I do think that in this one, we only have broken down a couple. I started lumping in one spot because it started lumping at the beginning and kind of was thinking about how wetland analyses are usually done, and we don't break things down very far other than it's an emergent or forested or scrub shrub. So most of the data that's going to come in from reports is going to be set up that way. But if we're splitting things very finely in these other habitat types, then we probably should divide up the wetlands more.
Is there a way that you can still keep those three or four broad categories and just have
I could just do subcategories under those.
Yeah.
I think as many places as possible where we can line up with existing
uses. Right.
Because if there's, say, there's some critter that has a specific niche,
might be able to refine it down by identifying those areas.
Right.
So, yeah, I can take these kind of broader categories that we tend to use in our reporting and then go into the subsections using the coordinating system and their subcategories in there.
Sounds good.
So that should work.
Okay.
This has may be nothing to do with where we're at, but it's almost towards the end here.
Mm-hmm.
Did somebody just transport those black squirrels from Seattle up this way? Or did they just follow the lines all the way up here?
There's a bunch of theories in that. Actually, the black ones come from Canada.
Yeah, okay.
And the gray ones,
and the
both Canada. Yeah, I think most of them have come from Canada down.
Right. The same species of squirrel, though.
Right. Yeah.
The
eastern gray squirrel. Yeah.
You meet my black squirrel as an immigrant?
Yes.
Yep. The invasive species, as a matter of fact, because they're very aggressive and they drive out Douglas squirrels and stuff.
I know. Every time I see him, he's always chasing the gray one around.
And there's got to be like, I calculate maybe 2 to 3 per household in the city of Bellingham.
Oh, at least.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah,
in the last 10 years, they've just ramped up.
Yeah, they flourish.
But there's a rumor of sometime in the early 80s, I think it was. Somebody brought in some squirrels and released them at Lake Whatcom, at Whatcom Falls Park. And I've heard this at some point, I can't remember where it came from, but sometime early 80s that happened, and somebody's blaming them on those. Where they came from, you know, it seems like Canada or not from Seattle. But they supposedly missed them from their household from wherever they lived before, so they let them loose.
That's funny.
Because when I moved here in 1980, there were no gray squirrels that were in Seattle, and I remember thinking, wow, no squirrels. And they certainly have just come on.
Yeah, I was going to remember in the 70s, and there were no squirrels like that.
No,
Now, they are getting into air breathing.
We used to just see them in Seattle running across the power lines.
Yeah, right.
And just more recently, that's the only reason I was asking about that. Was somebody just hauling them up in the It took that long for them to migrate up here by...
Well, I think either they migrated or they got brought in, and it took that long for their kind of core population just to explode.
Right.
They're definitely migrating, though, because, like, I saw the first one at my house that I've ever seen, like, 2 years ago, and I think it took that long for them to come out.
From there.
We don't really have them out.
And now I see them, in more out in open agricultural areas.
Well, I think you've got something that might eat them out there.
Dogs, barn owls and...
Coyotes.
It's a little harder out there, but they seem to do okay as long as there's some kind of disturbance.
Is that a known fact that they compete or they outcompete the red squirrel, or is it a habitat issue? Because red squirrels really don't hang out in the urban areas all that much, right? They need the conifers.
Where I've seen the two overlap, they
have different feeding patterns too, in terms of catching. Of their food sources.
They're much more aggressive about what they'll eat and including birds.
They're very territorial too, with the cravings there.
Well, so are the red squirrels.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I was just curious about if it was a habitat issue versus an actual conflict, you know.
I've never seen the actual study on it, but just from my observations, like checking a community forest over the years where there weren't gray squirrels, and now there are gray squirrels, and the Douglas squirrels have just dwindled.
Huh.
There's some there left, but not near the number that there used to be. And now you see the gray squirrels up in the Chuckanut as well.
Why isn't there a predator that's kind of come along today?
Specialize in them? I don't know. Yeah. But I think they need to start eating squirrel stew.
Squirrel jerky.
Squirrels are good.
Huh? Someone can make a living in Bellingham. There's a guy about a couple blocks from my house, Alabama, Cornwall. He goes to Costco every week and gets a gigantic bag of peanuts. Feeds the squirrels. He's got dozens and dozens of squirrels. So, you go out in your backyard and there's peanuts buried everywhere in your garden and everything.
At least peanuts aren't invasive yet.
Okay, so we're at our 5-minute mark. So Sean, I'll take a look at your kind of reformatting of the actual habitat and maybe just, somehow see how it matches up with what we have and just send that out for everyone. And I'll just send out a harassment email to encourage you guys to keep working on this.
Keep bugging us.
Yeah, and when do we want to meet up again? How long?
We have our next meeting is next week for the full committee, right?
Is that correct?
Is that right, or is it the following week?
No, it's not.
Let me.
I don't think it's for another 2 weeks.
Oh, okay. Let me find my correct.
I think I was actually supposed to put out a doodle poll for our next. I don't think we have another wildlife committee meeting scheduled.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that's why I'm not finding
it. Yep, so we are at third week in September currently. Based on our general timeline and how much we have left to do, I guess the sooner you guys are interested in getting back together. Works good with me.
Well, I guess it depends a little bit on when the next main meeting is.
Right.
We have that in another couple of weeks.
So just want to aim maybe for a full committee meeting, not next week, but the week after. So that would be the first week in October.
Yeah.
Maybe we could aim for a technical committee meeting that second week in October.
So between the 10th and the 14th?
Actually, the first week's really bad for me, but the next next week's okay.
That's what I was thinking, 10th to the 14th.
October 14th?
Somewhere between the 10th and the 14th, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'll be out of town leaving on the 14th, but earlier that week is fine.
Is the 10th a holiday?
10th is, well, for some.
Yeah, not for us. What holiday is that?
Columbus Day.
That's right.
That's every day.
Right.
So somewhere between the 11th and the 13th.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Okay, maybe I'll just...
Doodle poll that.
Yeah, I'll plot everyone with two doodle polls. So yeah, I guess the sooner you guys can respond to that, the better, just for scheduling purposes.
Okay.
And...
I just coordinate with you.
I'll email out that
Address.
Ecological systems document as well, too, because that's like pretty relevant.
Yeah.
Take a stab at it.
Okay. Call a meeting.
Call a meeting, done.
3:58.
Oh, yes.